acceptable to a critical mass of Democrats and acceptable to enough Republicans that gives him some kind of face-saving way to declare victory without really delivering much on the wall front. The problem with that, of course, is that the symbolism is important to the Democrats, too. So giving the president even a symbolic victory on this is not really what a lot of people who voted Democratic in the 2018 elections wanted to see, and it's not what a lot of Democrats want to do. And he needs enough Democrats in the Senate to vote with him for any resolution to this shutdown to take place.
You talk about the important symbolism for the president here. Let me ask you just about the substance. I mean, as you talk to voters who support this president, are they open to spending money on things that would secure the border other than a wall? I mean, are there other options the president has to do some face saving, as you put it?
You know, in my view, substantively, the wall is not the best way to achieve the immigration objectives that the president laid out in his campaign. And since he's been in office, I think that targeting the employers of undocumented immigrants, mandating the use of E-Verify, reviving the use of employer sanctions would be much more effective than building the wall of some sort of fencing in certain parts of the border can be helpful. I mean, but you do at this point have half to a majority of undocumented immigrants are coming in legally and overstaying their visas, and a wall really won't do very much for that. But I think that the wall became such an important part of the imagery of the Trump campaign, and the president himself has said that when he saw the attention spans of his rally audiences beginning to wane, he would lead a build the wall chant, and that would get everybody engaged again. So I think that the wall has, for both the president's detriment, but also to some extent to his political benefit, at least with his core base, has just become of outsized importance here.
Who stands to lose more if this shutdown goes into more days and weeks?
Well, obviously, I think a big problem for the president is that he took such a proactive stand in saying that he would own the shutdown. He said that on television in a way that could very easily be turned into advertising clips, said that he'd be proud to claim that mantle as long as the shutdown was over. Immigration control, and that might have, in the short term, been good at rallying the troops, at least among his base. But when you get to the voters beyond the base, it's going to be very hard for Trump to then pivot, as he's tried a bit to do on Twitter, and blame the Democrats for the shutdown and avoid blame himself. So over time, I think this will be branded as the Trump shutdown, and the pressure will mount on him to back down in some sense and reopen the parts of the federal government that are closed.
Jim Antle is editor of the American Conservative magazine. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
2018 was another year of devastating mass shootings and another year of debates about gun control. Before we get to the story, as we've often said over the course of this year while reporting on mass shootings, there is some disturbing audio in this piece. Last week, the Trump administration moved to ban bump stocks. Those are devices that make semi-automatic weapons fire more quickly. It was a victory for gun control advocates, who also successfully pushed states to enact dozens of gun control measures. As NPR's Melissa Block reports, advocates link that legislative success to a specific turning point.
That turning point came early in 2018.
Oh, please, I gotta know.
February 14th, please, Valentine's Day.
I'm getting a school shooting at Stillman Douglas High School in Parkland.
A shooter killed 17 students and staff at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Within 3 months, there was another mass shooting at another high school, this one in Santa Fe, Texas. 10 people were killed.
All we heard was run, run, and next thing you know, we hear boom, boom, boom.
And on it went. 11 worshipers killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. 12 killed, plus the shooter, at a bar in Thousand Oaks, California. The mother of one of those victims made this plea.
And I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control, and I hope to God nobody else sends me any more prayers.
So what about gun control in 2018? Well, in Florida, nicknamed the Gunshine State, new laws came quickly. Just a few weeks after the Parkland shooting, Republican Governor Rick Scott, who previously had an A-plus rating from the NRA, broke with the group and signed a package of new gun restrictions.
I was very surprised.
Allison Anderman is managing attorney with the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence.
To pass a package of bills that included an extreme risk protection order, raise the minimum age to purchase guns, prohibited bump stocks, extended waiting periods, I think was tremendous.
And soon after that, the Republican governor of Vermont, another gun-friendly state, signed the most extensive gun control measures that state has seen. The Gifford Center says 2018 marks a tectonic shift, with more than half the states passing dozens of new gun control laws. Contrast that with 2013, after the elementary school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, when states passed more laws loosening gun restrictions rather than tightening them. Allison Anderman credits a lot of this year's momentum to the student activists from Parkland.
They have brought such a level of passion and a new voice, a voice from a younger generation that is saying, look at what you have done to us, America. You have put us in harm's way, and we are not going to stay silent.
Another dramatic shift in 2018. In this election cycle, gun control groups outspent gun rights groups for the first time ever. And Democratic congressional candidates successfully campaigned on a gun control message.
Now it's a different world.
Chris Brown, president of the Brady Campaign and Center to Prevent Gun Violence, says with a Democratic majority poised to take power in the House of Representatives,
we have individuals elected who are committed to changing this issue, and many of whom feel that they've been elected with a mandate to make this a top priority. That is a sea change, and it's the beginning of something. It's not the end.
I would be lying if I said I thought it was a victorious year for us.
That's Michael Hammond, legislative counsel for the group Gun Owners of America, which bills itself as the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington.
We're the group that keeps the NRA honest.
Hammond points to some victories at the state level, including four states that expanded stand your ground and self-defense laws. But he's disappointed that the Republican-controlled Congress failed to pass one of the gun lobby's key goals, requiring states to recognize concealed carry permits from all other states. Now, he says, with Democrats in control of the House, the outlook is worse.
It makes it impossible, I think, to pass proactive legislation.
In fact, Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker-designate, has vowed to make passing universal background checks an early priority. More gun control measures are likely to follow, and lobbyist Lawrence Keene will be among those working to defeat them. He's with the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which represents the gun industry.
I would expect to see an age restriction bill. I expect we'll see an attempt to ban modern sporting rifles again. But what can get out of the House and what can pass the Senate are two different animals.
Keene and other gun rights activists are heartened by one long-lasting effect of 2018, a strengthened conservative majority on the Supreme Court. With this year's confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, Keene concludes, the Second Amendment is in a safer place. Melissa Block, NPR News, Washington.
Later this afternoon on All Things Considered, critics of the new question about citizenship on the 2020 census include some Japanese Americans. We'll explain why. You can listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or just ask for your local member station by name. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:19, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Ahead on the program, it's Wisconsin Life, and today we have a breakup story that involves technology. Kissing your cell phone goodbye in 25 minutes.
WPR's Brady Carlson shares his thoughts on bringing you the news.
I'm here to help you understand the news. And in my case, that means presenting the news. It means sharing the information that we've gathered. I can't always make the news more upbeat or more optimistic, but I can at least say I'm right there with you.
Join Brady Carlson every weekday for the BBC News Hour at 3, followed by All Things Considered at 4 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, devoted to keeping higher education accessible through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More information is at supportuw.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, books, and more. Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911.
In WPR weather for today, cloudy, and we're expecting rain, a wintry mix, or all snow, depending on where you are. That'll start in the afternoon and evening hours, and northern Wisconsin could see 1 to 3 inches of snow, highs in the 30s. A wintry mix in the north on Thursday, plus the possibility of a few inches of accumulation there, rain in the south, and windy, highs tomorrow in the mid-30s to the upper 40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com. From the Craig Newmark Foundation, committed to the values of fairness, opportunity, and respect. The Newmark Foundation supports veterans and military families, voting rights, truth in journalism, and women in tech. And from Doctors Without Borders, with medical teams on the ground in more than 70 countries. Last year, Doctors Without Borders provided medical care to more than 11 million people. Learn more at doctorswithoutborders.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. The Trump White House is setting records for staff turnover.
Yet another bombshell shakes the foundation of the Trump administration.
Gary Cohn announced his resignation.
Sean Spicer.
Steve Bannon.
Don McGahn. Forced out after a short and stormy tenure at the White House.
Reince Priebus is out as White House Chief of Staff.
His Chief of Staff, John Kelly, is leaving the White House by the end of the year.
But as the year winds down, rather than look back on who is gone, NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith has this look at who survived.
On the second full day of the Trump presidency, all the top White House aides gathered in the East Room to be sworn in by Vice President Pence.
I state your full name.
They raised their right hands and pledged.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Most of them are gone, but not counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway. When I sat down in her office to interview her, she pointed out a large framed photograph on the wall, taken that day, January 22nd.
In the photo are 7 or 8 different faces of assistants to the president who have moved on or no longer here. Were either fired and forced out or resigned voluntarily. And I've had the picture up basically from day one, but as each one left, it became a running joke of those who remained.
Former White House counsel Don McGahn was the last one to go, and he wrote Conway a note telling her she could take the picture down, but she isn't sure she will.
It's a good reminder of where we started and where we are and the durability and toughness and longevity that some of us have.
Conway is one of the survivors. Others who started on day one and are still there include Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, presidential son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner, senior policy advisor Stephen Miller, social media director Dan Scavino, and Johnny DiStefano, who started as personnel director but now wears several hats. He's the one you've probably never heard of. DiStefano is an experienced Washington hand who worked for former House Speaker John Boehner, among others. Michael Steele worked with him in Boehner's office.
He is a smart guy who's going to do his work and has no interest in being on cable news, has no interest in reading his name in the newspaper. He's a serious and hardworking public servant. That shouldn't be a distinguishing feature, but in this administration, it seems to be.
Miller, Sanders, and Conway are unbroken threads from the campaign. And Scavino, the social media director, goes back even further. He worked as a caddy at one of Trump's golf courses when he was a teenager.
He occupies such a unique role and such a trusted role.
Again, Conway.
He really is the man behind the mission, the mission of this president to communicate directly with America.
Scavino may be like family, but Kushner actually is family. He just helped push through criminal justice legislation and most recently was seen up on Capitol Hill trying to negotiate a solution to the government shutdown. So what do all of these people have in common?
Endurance.
Mark Lauder was Vice President Pence's press secretary early in the administration. He's now part of the 2020 Campaign Advisory Committee, and he's only sort of joking about the endurance thing.
He wants his staff people debating. He wants to hear the bad side arguments from one side and the good on the other, and he's going to pit them against each other. But when he makes the decision, your job is to go out and execute.
Which is to say, the survivors have a high tolerance for conflict, and in the end, will do or say what President Trump asks, something outgoing Defense Secretary James Mattis ultimately wasn't willing to do. I asked Sarah Sanders what she thinks she and her fellow survivors have in common.
The biggest thing is that the people that are here really believe in what we're doing and believe that we're making a difference, and we're proud of the work that we do every day.
That's exactly what you'd expect the president's top spokesperson to say. Before our quick interview was over, I felt I had to ask her an awkward question, and I did so awkwardly.
Is anybody on this list going to leave before my story airs?
Not that I know of. Certainly don't think so and don't hope so.
It looks like she was right. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
This month, Chinese authorities raided some of the country's most prominent independent churches, shutting them down and arresting their pastors. As NPR's Rob Schmitz reports, China's government has stepped up its campaign against Christianity, a religion it sees as having problematic foreign ties.
Police raided the Early Rain Covenant Church on December 9th, a Sunday evening, while congregants gathered for services. Video captured of the raid shows officers separating a child from her father as they detain 100 churchgoers. The church, based in the southwestern city of Chengdu, has 500 members and is one of several high-profile independent churches that have been raided by China's government this year for what it calls illegal religious activity.
I think the government sees religion as a double-edged sword.
Ian Johnson is the author of The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao.
On the one hand, it is promoting some religions like Buddhism and Taoism and folk religions, but in terms of these other religions that they think are have too many foreign ties and can be influenced by outsiders, it's taking a very hardline approach. It's all part and parcel of a broader effort to control civil society.
Johnson says Chinese authorities are cracking down on churches that are not officially sanctioned by the government. Nearly half of China's 60 million Christians attend these unregistered churches. The raid on Early Rain was preceded by a raid in September by Beijing police on that city's Zion Church, which had 1,500 members. In his book, Johnson profiled Early Rain's pastor, Wang Yi. At a sermon in September, Wang calls Chinese leader Xi Jinping a sinner, while congregants answer with amen. It was this, Wang's increasing political activism, that Johnson says likely contributed to his arrest.
He's denounced Xi Jinping lifting the term limits on the presidency so that he could become president for life. He said that this was destroying the Constitution and similar to creating a new Caesar.
The 45-year-old pastor Wang Yi and his wife now face up to 15 years in prison on charges of subverting state power. His church remains sealed off to the public, and in the week following the raid, another prominent church in China's southern province of Guangdong has been raided by Chinese police, too. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Shanghai.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration has so drastically cut the number of refugees allowed into the U.S., some advocates fear the system is collapsing.
We would not be surprised if we do not have this program at the end of this administration, if there isn't some type of intervention by Congress to change the shape of this program.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Hear about the fallout from the cuts this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered. It starts at 4 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Morning Edition here on WPR. A news update from NPR is up next. Following that, in the WPR newscast, we'll hear about a new study that indicates student athletes in Wisconsin who have less access to athletic trainers don't get concussions identified as much as they should.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Today is the first business day of the federal government shutdown that began at midnight Friday. The main sticking point is President Trump's $5 billion demand for a border wall with Mexico. NPR's Ina Jaffe says there were reports Trump would accept less money than he originally asked for, but that seems to be a changing situation.
Reportedly, administration officials have told Democrats that Trump could accept less for the border wall than the more than $5 billion he's demanded. But according to a statement from Senate and House Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the counteroffers change depending on who in the administration is making them.
NPR's Ina Jaffe. The Senate will be back in session tomorrow to work on a possible deal. Israeli airstrikes have hit an arms depot near Damascus, wounding three soldiers. That's according to Syrian state media reports. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Jerusalem.
According to reports, Israeli warplanes struck sites where Hezbollah militants and Iranian forces stored weapons. Israel wouldn't confirm, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently said Israel might expand its efforts to act against Iranian military entrenchment in Syria.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 158 points. This is NPR News.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio, 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A new study finds student athletes are more likely to have misdiagnosed and mistreated concussions the less access they have to athletic trainers. These trainers are licensed medical providers equipped to diagnose head injuries after blows to the head. The trainers can avoid clearing athletes to return to play too soon. Researchers at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health found only a third of the state's 400 high schools have athletic trainers available during practices and games. Researcher Tim McGuine says some athletes may not show symptoms right after a concussion.
So everybody is case dependent. There are some similarities, but each athlete and each concussion has to be looked at as a different identifiable event and treated as such.
If brains don't have time to heal fully, they'll be prone to more concussions in the future. Wisconsin regulators are investigating whether a contractor who caused a fatal explosion in a Madison suburb violated state law. A VC Tech employee ruptured a natural gas line in Sun Prairie in July while installing fiber optic lines, resulting in an explosion that killed firefighter Corey Barr. Court documents allege USIC locating services incorrectly marked the line's location. Bear Communications initially hired Jet Underground to do the work. VC Tech was set to finish the project. Jet Underground requested USIC mark the line, but court documents allege the locating service incorrectly marked it. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that State Public Service Commission on December 17th began investigating a USIC complaint against VC Tech. USIC alleges VC Tech should have asked USIC to mark the line again. Police in Fond du Lac say a 37-year-old man has died after showing signs of medical distress in the back of a squad car. Authorities say Fond du Lac police officers performed a traffic stop Sunday night. Authorities say the Fond du Lac man who was driving the vehicle was out on bail and was taken into custody without incident for violating his bond conditions. Police say the man began showing signs of medical distress while he was in the back of a police squad car. He was taken by ambulance to St. Agnes Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Three Fond du Lac police officers are on standard administrative assignment. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Mary, Queen of Scots. A rebellious young queen stops at nothing to reclaim her throne. Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie star as warring queens, now playing in theaters everywhere. And from iDrive, maker of Remote PC, promoting real-time remote access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere, for use when telecommuting or for remote management. Learn more at remotepc.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. An 8-year-old migrant boy from Guatemala died in U.S. government custody on Monday night. Just a few weeks ago, a 7-year-old girl, also from Guatemala, died, also after being apprehended by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe has been covering the stories of migrants near the southern border, and she's on the line with me now from El Paso. Good morning, Monica.
Hi, good morning.
So what else do we know about this little Guatemalan boy who died?
Well, what we know is what Customs and Border Protection has put out now in a second statement since yesterday, which is that the boy, who was 8 years old, died shortly before midnight on Christmas Day. Earlier, they had said that he died shortly after midnight on Christmas Day. And we know from that statement that he was hospitalized the day before Christmas Eve with a cold, released after given ibuprofen and antibiotics, but he later returned to the hospital after he began vomiting and died there. My colleague here in El Paso, who reports for the Washington Post, found out that the boy was held at a Border Patrol checkpoint 100 miles north of El Paso due to overcrowding at the facilities here. And these are checkpoints. They're small stations that travelers pass on the highway as they move away from the border, and they're not the kind of facilities equipped for long-term stays. CBP has also said that it's considering a, quote, surge in medical assistance for children in their custody, and that they may seek help from other agencies like the Coast Guard, FEMA, and Health and Human Services.
That sounds like an acknowledgement that this tragedy needs to be addressed. I understand you've been in El Paso talking with families who've just been released from custody, but they were released without warning, so the local volunteers who would typically help them were caught unaware. What is the scene down there? What have people been telling you?
Sure. I talked with some of these migrants, most of them Central American families, in a park a block away from the Greyhound station in downtown El Paso. They had just been released from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody. So that experience was front and center in their mind. I spoke with one Guatemalan mother. Her name was Kenya Hernandez, and she teared up describing that experience.
Bueno, cuando lo agarra migración, estar ahí acostada en el suelo, en la suciedad.
She says they stayed on a filthy floor and didn't get enough to eat or drink. Others told me they were in a windowless, crowded room where they couldn't tell whether it was day or night. I saw children still holding the paper-thin blankets that looked like tinfoil given to them by the authorities. Some had no shoes. One boy was feverish and had to be picked up by an ambulance. Now, imagine 400 people in this state. I recall a mother who was holding her infant child and looking up at a volunteer and asking, "Estamos libre?" which means, "Are we free?"
A lot down there seems like it needs to be worked out. Reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe, thank you so much for following this for us.
You're welcome.
A century ago, the Iraqi city of Mosul was one of the region's most prosperous and religiously diverse cities. Jewish history there goes back almost 3,000 years to ancient Nineveh. The battle against ISIS heavily damaged the oldest part of the city. NPR's Jane Araf tells us the violence laid bare a piece of Jewish heritage.
This is the house where I was born, Zaid Ahmed tells me. We're in Mosul's historic old city, high stone walls on either side of a twisting narrow alley, leading to what's left of a grand old house. Ahmed, like almost everyone in Mosul now, is Muslim. His family home is huge, with marble arches and colorful decorated pillars in the old Jewish quarter. In fact, the house Ahmed's grandfather bought in 1956 from the Iraqi government was a synagogue.
This room is where the cleric sat. He taught in Hebrew, and this was their only church in the neighborhood.
By church, he means synagogue. Mosul's Jewish community has been gone for so long, most people don't know the word for rabbi anymore. But Ahmed remembers from his father and grandfather, the Jews who worshiped there prayed facing west, the direction of Jerusalem. And they told him that when Iraqi Jews were forced to leave the country after the creation of Israel, they left a big gap.
Before they left, they came to say goodbye to my grandfather, and they said, "Sayyid Hamid, you were a good neighbor. We had nothing against each other. We didn't hurt them, and they didn't hurt us."
Ahmed says his grandfather even had a photo of Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir hanging in the house.
It's a cemetery.
He shows me the remains of a religious school next to the synagogue. He says there was also a workshop here. And he whispers that there are still Jewish graves under the courtyard. For years, the building went unnoticed. If it weren't for the battle against ISIS, it still would be. The fighting destroyed part of the ceiling and some of the walls. ISIS fighters lived here for a while. And there are bullet casings everywhere. You have to climb over piles of rubble to make your way inside. And when the old city was lying in ruins after the fighting, a lot of people did.
ISIS came, then airstrikes hit the house, thieves came to the house, people came and took things. The Directorate of Antiquities came and took two pieces.
Ahmed and his brothers show me holes in the thick walls where two Hebrew inscriptions were chipped out.
So it's a room with iron bars that's full of rubble, but it has these vaulted ceilings, and you can tell it was lovely once. But in the wall, someone from the Department of Antiquities actually dug out some of the marble plaques that had Hebrew writing in them.
The director of antiquities later tells me his department took two inscriptions and padlocked the door to protect the house. He acknowledges it's legally owned by Ahmed's family, but says it's too dangerous for anyone to live there. At least two other inscriptions were believed stolen, and according to neighborhood residents, are being shopped around for sale. Ahmed paints cars for a living. He has a 14-year-old son who was badly wounded 2 years ago and needs operations the family can't afford. He and his brothers and sisters would like to sell the house, but it could be difficult because the antiquities department would have to agree to it. He shows me where he used to play in a small pool in the courtyard as a child, and the room where he got married, where his grandfather used to sit propped up by pillows to eat oranges and drink coffee with the Jewish neighbors. That was a nicer time in Mosul, he says, when no one cared what religion you were. Jane Araf, NPR News, Mosul.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio and 8:42 right now. Ahead on the program, in the era of Time's Up and Me Too, women continue to struggle in the world of country music, and many are taking matters into their own hands and bypassing the industry's gatekeepers. We'll have that story for you in 9 minutes. Stay with us.
WPR has been a radio pioneer for more than 100 years. Today, listener support is the largest source of funding. As a donor, you can be proud of the history you've created. Thanks to you, WPR's future includes more in-depth news, world-class music, and great discussions. Continue the spirit of innovation. Make your year-end gift now at WPR.org, and thank you.
Support for WPR comes from History Museum at the Castle in Appleton, committed to giving back to the community with history for the holidays, featuring family-friendly exhibits, now through January 6th, myhistorymuseum.org.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
Good morning. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are some of the top stories we're following today. North Korea is hoping to someday link its railway with its southern neighbor, but without progress in nuclear negotiations, regular trains won't be crossing the border anytime soon. Both countries broke ground today on an ambitious project to modernize the North's railways and roads and connect them to South Korea. U.S. Customs and Border Protection will start conducting medical checks on every child in its custody now that a second child has died while in its care. CBP says 8-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso of Guatemala had been in its care along with his father since December 18th. a 7-year-old Guatemalan girl, died earlier this month. More news from NPR and WPR on our website. Go to WPR.org. In the weather forecast for today, cloudy skies, rain, a wintry mix, or all snow will start in the afternoon and evening hours, and northern Wisconsin could see 1 to 3 inches of snow, highs in the 30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dreamwave, maker of luxury massage chairs from Japan, with shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning, night, and stretch sessions. Retailers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com.
It's 8:45, time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about breaking up with technology.
I bet some of you listening are a little addicted to your phones, keeping up with texts, social media, news updates, and cat videos. Some days, you might spend more time with your phone than the actual living, breathing people in your lives. Madison comedian Esteban Tuma just got out of an unhealthy relationship with his phone, and he offers this cautionary tale.
I should have seen it coming. Right after my phone broke up with me, I recalled all the signs I had missed. It had been acting pretty distant lately. It felt like every notification came with a sigh, every calendar input a bit testy, every response to the on button a little off. I mean, I guess I had been distant too, keeping it in my pocket while having dinner or reading a book in the bathroom, a book? And always with the perfect excuse, zero photos of the Steely Dan tribute concert. I had low battery. No emojis in a 2-hour span. I was driving. I guess I could have at least checked it for notifications during the boring stretches of highway, but no, I kept it in my back pocket like some cheap leather wallet. Have things really changed that much since we first met at the Verizon store months ago? I was there looking for anything, an LG, hell, even a Samsung, something casual I could use for a couple months. Nothing too serious, I just wanted to have some fun. But as I browsed, Dan, the clerk, pointed it out from across the store. That one would be perfect for you, he said. I felt like a boy watching my prom date descend the stairs. My heart was racing. I had it unpackaged before we even got to the car. We spent an hour just getting to know each other right there in the mall parking lot, our first date. But now it wouldn't even respond to my pleas. At least tell me why. Burn my pocket, delete my photos, anything but the silent mode treatment. At least give me the, it's not you, it's my operating system line. I laid awake in bed that night thinking, where had our intimacy gone? Like when I changed the pin lock to thumb recognition. The phone gently shook after those 3 seconds of contact, opening its home screen to me as I slowly explored the pages of the app's menu. The screen gradually warming as I slid down the notifications panel. I dimmed the brightness and... This is no ordinary love. I couldn't sleep at all. The next morning, I grabbed some coffee and tried to stay positive. I can still fix things, I said. I started by asking my so-called buddies on the tech support forum, have you tried a hard reset? XX Crush Bites XX asked. A hard reset? Was he crazy? And erase everything with Build Together? No. I logged out without even saying goodbye. I needed professional advice, and there was only one place where I could get it. Back at the Verizon store, Dan remembered us right away. Let me see what I can do, he said kindly. After several minutes that seemed like hours, Dan called me over with a sad nod. It's best if you both move on, he said. And he was right, and I knew it. Heartbroken, I asked, can I just pick up my SIM and SD cards? Dan gave me a minute. The phone waited in silence as I grabbed my things. I held the battery in my hands, feeling its heat one last time. The phone was totally dark now. Nothing but a black screen reflecting back to me what could have been. I got in my car, wiped my tears, and turned on the radio. Maybe I'd call the guys, grab a beer at that place near the Apple store. It's been a while. I wonder what Apple's been up to, I thought. Maybe I'd drop in and see what's up. Maybe find something casual, something fun. You know, nothing too serious.
Esteban Tuma is a comedian in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lakelawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lakelawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakelawnResort.com.
Trains winding through a holiday scene with poinsettias and fresh evergreens. WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly events. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
Good morning. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and the program is just about over for the day. Still a little bit more, but stay with us. Stephanie Elkins will be in just after 9 with classical music for you. A rag by Scott Joplin, a Mozart divertimento, and Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 4 are lined up for this morning. Stay tuned.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. Many of the modern country stars who've had the broadest cultural impact have been women. Think about Shania Twain, the Dixie Chicks, Taylor Swift. But sometimes it could seem like the country music world is dominated by men, at least based on radio airplay. In early December, Billboard magazine announced that for the first time, its country airplay chart listed no women in the top 20. But Julie Height reports that Nashville's enterprising young women are seeking out alternate routes to an audience.
Kaylee Shore was so driven to pursue a country music career that she graduated high school early and worked two jobs to save up for her move to Nashville.
You're rocky terrain, but I know what I'm getting into. No need to explain everything that she did to you.
When she arrived in Music City in 2012, she knew the drill. Find co-writers, a band, and a producer, land gigs, and a deal with a song publisher.
And then you meet with record labels, and then you get signed to one, and then you release that song to radio, and then boom, you're there. And that's a lot of people's path, but I had a little bit of a derailment right around those last three steps because I'm a woman. Yeah.
Shore learned that she wasn't alone. Decision makers seem more reluctant to take chances on young female singers and songwriters, even when they showed talent. 3 years into Shore's Nashville tenure, a country radio consultant spelled out the gender bias in an interview with a food metaphor. He insisted it was best for radio ratings to treat songs by female artists as tomatoes garnishing an otherwise male salad.
So when it happened, like, no one was surprised, but everyone was so off. But then we were also excited because we were like, oh, great, we're talking about it. So it's going to fix, right? And how many years has it been now?
Tomatogate hadn't even happened when Leslie Fram, a senior vice president at Country Music Television, launched a promotional campaign called Next Women of Country. Shore is among the dozens of artists that Fram has included in video premieres, web features, live showcases, and tours over the last half decade.
We recognized early on, but the fact that we're still having this conversation is shocking. I feel like we have to do more. We have to get more exposure for these artists outside of terrestrial radio, outside of playlisting.
Fram and a couple of other industry veterans also spearhead an advocacy group called Change the Conversation that spent the last 4 years hosting town hall meetings, presenting research on the marketing power of female stars, and mentoring women. But since change has been slow to come, artists have taken on the issue themselves. Some use social media, a podcast, or stage banter. Shore and her collaborators have gotten buzz with topical songs.
Time's up for the ruthless, the wicked, and the vain. Time's up for the cheaters,
'cause now the game has changed. It's been a long time coming, there's a new day dawning, gonna stop your running today. The wait's over for the patient, the humble and the brave.
Along with fellow artist Savannah Keys, Shore recently agreed to co-host a daily Radio Disney Country segment on women that will reach listeners mostly through satellite and streaming.
It's great because it does put me at the forefront of this conversation. I've gotten a lot of press from non-country outlets because they know that I'll be outspoken about it because I can be because I'm independent.
This year, Shore applied that attitude to the sound of her self-released music. She kept on writing catchy hooks, but worked in the emo guitar riffs she loves.
Well, I never knew how strong I was until I found me, and I gave you up. What do you do when you're lost in space and nothing really seems to shine?
And Shore made it clear to fans that she was prioritizing being true to herself.
I was like, I don't make music for rich people in suits. I make music for these people. And as long as they're happy with it and they connect to it and they're taking something away from it, I don't need a label.
So most Monday nights, Shore performs in a songwriter's round called Song Suffragettes, alongside a rotating cast of like-minded peers.
Hey, guys. Oh, y'all look so beautiful tonight. My name is Kaylee Shore, and we are the Song Suffragettes, and we are so excited that y'all decided to spend your Monday with us. We started Song Suffragettes after noticing that there was a pretty massive gender disparity in country music.
Shore's manager, Todd Cassidy, co-founded Song Suffragettes and says the fact that 1,400 riders have applied to join to date is a sign that it remains a much-needed outlet.
We started it almost 5 years ago with the hope that giving a platform, giving an opportunity, would really help move the needle in a macro way. And in small ways it has. You know, we've made a mark. A lot of our women have been able to score publishing deals or record deals.
Chloe Gilligan signed with a publisher who saw her at one of those shows. While she figures out the next steps for her career, she leans on the solidarity of the group, as she explains backstage.
This to me was a different type of community of songwriters where everyone's just so supportive, and it's not really competition necessarily, more like if you win, then I win.
Like a lot of Nashville's rising women, Gilligan fills her songs with intimate details and delivers them like she's allowing audiences into her imagination.
I ended up writing a whole song in the corner of a club because I was mad.
That is the most on-brand Chloe Gilligan thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, go to the club, angrily type lyrics into your iPhone.
Oh, and he knows it's about him too. Like, there ain't no bones about it. This song's about this guy, so this is called Blow Your Cover.
I can still taste the peppermint on my tongue, the bouncer said, have a good one.
That's a fairly new development for mainstream country. The genre stars often used to turn to professional songwriters for tunes that were broadly relatable in arena scale. Now that a lot of the old rules no longer seem to apply for women in country, more and more of them are exploring the potential of an individualized singer-songwriter approach, says Song Suffragette Regan Stewart.
You can tell that everyone's perspective now is changing to, like, okay, I'm just going to be me, and that's going to work, and I'm going to make that work.
For proof that it can work, both Stewart and Kaylee Shore look to what was accomplished this year by an artist who's been at this longer than they have. Kacey Musgraves took her latest album in a psychedelic and reflective direction without giving radio a moment's thought, and was celebrated for it.
I'd rather be Kacey Musgraves and, you know, be able to go on this world tour and get nominated for Album of the Year at the Grammys than have a number one people forget about.
Shore and plenty of her counterparts are playing the long game. As Musgraves put it in a song,
I'm all right with a slow burn.
For NPR News, I'm Julie Height in Nashville.
Taking my time, let the world turn. I'm gonna do it my way, it'll be all.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us at 3 for more of the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4 o'clock. It's a minute before 9. Stay with us. News from NPR and WPR is next.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Since 1931, Piasecki Althaus has provided unmatched, compassionate service and are dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. 262-658-4101.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.